So William, first of all, thank you very much for agreeing to do this and join us on the podcast. I thought it would be a great idea if you could just tell us a bit about your story, how you became to be the head of the Oxford Mindfulness Centre, how you were first introduced to mindfulness and to Mark Williams and your own, in your own mindfulness journey, if you like.
So when I was initially training as a young clinical psychologist, young scientist, my research area was depression, mood disorders. And at that time, mindfulness, meditation, the idea of going on retreats really wasn't in the mainstream at all. And in fact, for me to have talked about that in my professional life would have been, professional suicide might be too strong, but it wouldn't have been a good thing for a young scientist to have done. So I used to go on retreats, have a mindfulness practice of my own, and that was very much part of my kind of personal life and was very important to me as a young person finding my way in the world. And meanwhile, I was developing my science around depression and cognitive behavioral approaches to depression. And I went to a conference in the mid-1990s, which was called East Meets West. And John Kabat-Zinn was there, Francisco Varela was there, and John Teasdale was there. And John Teasdale took me to the bar and bought me a drink and said, you know, your interest in mindfulness and your interest in depression, there's a way of bringing these two together. And it was a wonderful, wonderful moment where two things that were very important to me, my work and mindfulness and my own life, were able to come together. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, my research has all been around mindfulness, and mindfulness is a way of helping people with recurrent depression find ways of staying well in the long term.
I was, you know, you mentioned being a young person finding your way in the world. It's pretty much similar to our story, you know, how we came across mindfulness and looking at sort of how mindfulness is presented as a way to help people with clinical depression and all the sort of the scientific aspect, and quite separate from its sort of Eastern roots, as sort of very much tied in with the philosophical aspect of the, say, you know, the Buddhist traditions. I mean, we're not Buddhists ourselves, but do you think there are implications, like philosophically speaking, with mindfulness as a way of life, besides from the fact that it's, say, as effective as, say, taking drugs for helping depression? Is there something to be commented on about that?
It's a really interesting question, and I think when we teach mindfulness in the context of mindfulness-based programs, whether that's to children in schools or whether it's in the context of the health service to people with recurrent depression, what we're teaching is for people to stop and become more familiar with their minds and with their bodies, and to begin to learn different ways of being with the world. Now, where that will take people, you can never quite predict. Now, in the context of depression, the intention is to take people to learning a set of skills that they can learn to stay well in the long term. But I have certainly in my own life and heard from many people that people take that in all sorts of interesting directions. Yes. The very process of becoming more aware and more responsive in the world leads people to ask questions about their relationships, about their words, about their vocation, about their values. But that's not necessarily the intention.
Yes.
But the awareness has that kind of revealing and transforming quality. And what I think is so, I think, powerful about mindfulness-based programs is that that journey is at the level of the individual and their experience. So they are learning from their own mindfulness practice and from their own application of that practice in the world about what leads to less suffering, greater happiness, greater effectiveness. But that's not necessarily what you're setting out to do in a kind of didactic way, if that makes sense.
So why don't we, for our listeners and viewers, perhaps if you could give a definition of what mindfulness is.
Great question.
Such an open question, and I understand, but I would like to ask that question again at the end. But if we could give a textbook answer that you would give if someone asked you what is mindfulness.
So my answer of what is mindfulness is that it has four parts to it. The first is that actually it's just a natural capacity that we all have. Everybody has an innate natural capacity to be mindful, and it can be trained. But it's a natural capacity that's trainable. That's the first part. The second part, that it has a sort of quality of attention and awareness, that what we are talking about with mindfulness is being able to attend to things quite intentionally, quite deliberately. So I can choose in this moment to attend entirely into my conversation with you two guys. And I can be aware of the sounds and the wider room. So there's something about an innate capacity, there's something about attention and awareness. And I think the third part is really, really key. And it's about something about the sort of attitudes that we're cultivating. It's not cold, it's not about a cold attention. It's about curiosity, it's about patience, it's about balance and equanimity, and it's about kindness. Mm-hmm. So that kind of landscape of attention gets, I don't know, imbued with all of those kind of qualities. And the final part is what we were just talking about, is it actually has an aim or an intention. It's not ethically neutral at all. The intention is to lead a better life at some level, or with depression, to learn skills to stay well in the long term. Mm-hmm. Or the way it's taught in schools is to give young people the skills to better manage their minds and their worlds. Yeah. So it's those, I know that's quite a long answer, but I think it's really important that mm-hmm. all of those different components of mindfulness mm-hmm. are part of any good definition of mindfulness.
Yeah. And as you learn mindfulness and you get into meditation, I guess every time you hear that response, it will mean something new to yep. you, right? Because it's an ongoing process. It's not you tell someone that once and, yep, I've got it. Because you can't understand mindfulness just by definition. You actually have to live it, learn, go through the tough times, and it's, yes. and also continue to increase your understanding.
Absolutely. Right. It's a continual unfolding of understanding. Mm-hmm. The mind and body are extraordinarily rich and complex, and actually that deepening understanding is part of what mindfulness practice is about.
Yeah, and you know the saying goes that, you know, if you don't examine your life, then mm-hmm. it's almost not worth living. Mm-hmm. And you know, we found that practicing mindfulness and then trying to discuss the questions around it has mm-hmm. you know, helped be that piece where we can really understand, well, what is our purpose mm-hmm. in life, mm-hmm. and you know, why are we here? Mm-hmm. But when I try and have that conversation with someone that hasn't been practicing mindfulness mm-hmm. or you know, hasn't really taken the time to understand the relationship with their thoughts mm-hmm. and who they really are and their ego, mm-hmm. it's almost a very difficult conversation to yeah. have.
Yeah.
You know, so how do you face that problem? And do you explain it one way to some people and another way to different people?
Yeah. So I think it comes back to the intention of what you're trying to do. So I'll just give you an example from my own life. Is when my daughters were very young, I remember one night, it's a very kind of painful memory for me, which is I was reading my 5-6-year-old daughter a bedtime story. So I'd had a busy day at work, I'd come home, and I was putting her to bed, and I read her a bedtime story, and I got to the end of the chapter, and I was just about to say goodnight, and she wanted to talk about the story I just read her. Mm. Quite understandable.
Yeah.
I couldn't actually remember a single word of what I just read. I'd read the whole chapter yeah. on automatic pilot, mm-hmm. and my mind was actually still back at work. Mm-hmm. So here I have a very precious time with my daughter, and I wasn't actually present. Mm. And that, for me, was a moment where actually bringing mindfulness into my relationship with my daughter is so important. I mean, one of the most important things I feel I can do in my life is to be a parent. And to be present feels really important. So that was kind of a personal moment. There's one moment I remember of a former client of mine who was the mother of a young child. And what we do with the 8-week mindfulness program is we ask people in week two, between week two and week three, to go away and record a pleasant moment in their week every day, and really with mindfulness to unpack that moment in terms of what was I thinking, what was I feeling, what was happening in my moment, in my body, and what was happening in the world around me. And she was pushing a toddler on the swing. And the toddler was just delighted. He was very happy and laughing and chortling. And she thought to herself, ah, this is my moment to write on the mm-hmm. spreadsheet and to take back to my class at the end of the week as an example of a pleasant moment. Now, this young woman had suffered from depression. And right on the back of that thought of this is a pleasant moment came the thought, this won't last, followed quickly by another thought, which was, I don't deserve to be happy.
Mm.
And then whoosh, a whole bunch of other thoughts. I'm going to mess up my son. My son's going to have as messed up a life as I've got as well. And then all of a sudden, just like me when I was reading to my daughter, she's no longer present to her own child.
Mm.
And she's overcome with all of this negative thinking, this sense of inner collapse. And she described that moment with a beautiful, beautiful metaphor. And the metaphor was, it was a wrecking ball thought.
Mm-hmm.
That first thought was a wrecking ball thought. And the reason I love that metaphor is because with a wrecking ball, if it hits a building full on, it's incredibly powerful. But if you stand back from a wrecking ball,
mm-hmm.
it just travels through space
mm.
and will eventually run out of energy.
Yeah.
And so what she was able to do and what mindfulness enabled her to do was to be able to see that as a thought,
mm-hmm.
label it as a thought, a wrecking ball thought, stand back from it
mm-hmm.
and take the energy, take the destructive energy out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a transformative moment for her.
Yeah.
And potentially a transformative moment for her relationship with her child as well,
yeah.
because she was able to go back to being there for her toddler.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the key things about mindfulness that really struck me when I first started practicing was being able to notice thoughts as I sat down to
yeah.
do my practice.
Yeah.
So that in those moments
yeah.
where a negative moment, when I can realize it as a thought, go, oh,
mm-hmm.
it's that thought.
Mm-hmm.
It's that thing that I've been practicing every
mm-hmm.
day.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, that nip it in the bud,
mm-hmm.
so to speak, you know,
yep.
remove all that,
yep.
that energy
yep.
from it. And then you're able to continue
yep.
with the rest of the day. That thought might come again 10 seconds later
mm-hmm.
or a minute
mm-hmm.
later, but at least you've now got these tools that
yep.
can start to make little bits of progress.
So it's that moment of realization that this is a thought and being able to see it as just a thought. And so for many, many people, of course, that's not their reality. Thoughts are just experienced as a
reality.
Stream of reality.
Yes.
And that's what mindfulness enables people to do, is to first be able to recognize that,
mm-hmm.
allow those to be there with those qualities I was talking about of curiosity, of interest, of equanimity, of kindness, and step back from them. And then thoughts are impermanent.
Yeah. And which, you know, leads me to the topic of the second arrow,
mm-hmm.
which you mentioned, because there is actually another analogy that Anne and I frequently use, and we love to talk about it, and I'd love, you know, your take on it as well. It's the idea of the black and white square
mm-hmm.
on a chessboard.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that the story is set up is, you know, imagine life
mm-hmm.
to be a chessboard where
mm-hmm.
black and white squares, where the black represents, you know, the stuff that doesn't go well in your life,
mm-hmm.
and the white squares the good stuff. But as you begin this game of life, someone covers the board
mm-hmm.
with a sheet, and you have to traverse.
Mm-hmm.
And along the way, the odds of you making it without landing on the black square, you know, is virtually nil. So I guess the first point of that is, when you do land on one, you know, not to be so surprised, or not to, you know, because, you know, why be so surprised? You've expected this
mm-hmm.
along the way. But what really was profound for me and Anne
mm-hmm.
is that when we were looking on this chessboard, but what really was the black square?
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you know, oh shit, I've got a cold now, or I've just broken my leg or something. That could be interpreted as that black square moment. But every moment that follows
mm-hmm.
afterwards, and every other thought that then follows, needn't be a black square.
Mm-hmm.
But we realize that we do that in life a lot. We turn so many events into black squares.
Mm-hmm.
And one part that we enjoyed was, is a process of turning black squares into white squares.
Mm-hmm.
And we really enjoyed that analogy. When you mentioned the second arrow,
mm-hmm. yeah.
it's like, well, there's that primary thing, which is the incident itself. Maybe like when my granddad died.
Mm-hmm.
You know, death in the family is probably one of the worst that you can have as far as the black squares are concerned. But then I was able, I mean, you cry and you weep, but when I was in the office where being sad and being and crying was no use to me,
mm-hmm.
being every time that thought came in, that just take a breath, and then it was no longer a black square day.
Yeah.
I turned it into a white square.
Yeah.
So perhaps with the second arrow, maybe mm-hmm. could you comment on that?
It's lovely the way you've put that. And of course, I mean, the first thing I'd want to say is I think one of the misconceptions about mindfulness is this idea that there isn't the reality of real adversity for many people in their life. And you've given some examples of, you know, bereavements. But there is just a reality that some people live with economic deprivation, unemployment, ill health, and direct physical pain. So I don't want to minimize in that in any sense. Mm-hmm. But you're absolutely right that the second arrow of what the mind brings to those experiences is what the inquiry of mindfulness is about. And I think the way mindfulness-based programs are set up is they are set up in a way to enable people to really learn from their experience. And that can be really transformative because white squares, the joyful moments of life, so you've talked about the black mm-hmm. squares, but many, many people have like a sort of Teflon layer over the white squares. Mm. That's nice, that's great, like food.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How many people actually really stop to savor mm-hmm. nice food?
Yep.
Or just food?
Yep.
Or relationships or interactions? So the whites, it applies equally to the to what we think of as the white and the black. Mm-hmm. So in a way, if you just leave the white and the black, because the mind just very, very quickly says pleasant, unpleasant,
yes.
neutral, let's not pay attention to this. And what mindfulness is inviting us to do is just at that very first contact point with experience, try and bring that attention, awareness, curiosity, interest, and balance. And actually what we thought was there may not be there at all. Mm-hmm. So you may have heard of this, but with many of the mindfulness-based programs, they start with eating a raisin. Mm-hmm. And they invite people to bring all five senses to the raisin. And people very often describe, I had no idea that the moment I bite into the raisin, if it's a particular kind of raisin, the explosion of sweetness mm-hmm. in the mouth, and the way that kind of just resonates through the body is extraordinary. So it's the white squares. And then what do we do with that afterwards? Oh, that was interesting. I'll go home and I'll pick up a whole bunch of chocolate and just eat it and not taste it as well. So it's that. It's just that exploration. You're absolutely, yeah. absolutely right. And it's at very trivial levels. But I think you were alluding to earlier, it's at more profound levels too. Mm-hmm. So it's at the level of, you know, food to relationships to the job I'm in.
Yeah.
When I really stop and I'm aware of what it's like to go into work, to be at work, and to leave work. Mm-hmm. Is this, to use your method, is this a white square? Is it a black square? Is it something I want to be doing?
Yeah.
It's a rich, rich exploration.
You know, we represent action for happiness.
Yeah.
You know, where happiness is the key theme for us. Mm-hmm. So, I guess, could you go through some of the scientific studies or the research that's been done recently to kind of that demonstrates the link with mindfulness and happiness?
Yeah. So I'm going to turn that slightly on its head and say that I work primarily with depression. Mm-hmm. Depression it has two parts to it. One is where sort of the negative system really comes online. Negative thoughts. Loss of pleasure, all of that comes online. But at the same time, what's happening is the whole capacity for pleasure, the capacity for joy gets knocked out. And I think the long-term journey of recovery from depression has three parts to it. The first is about being able to work with those negative thoughts, being able to work with those negative experiences and to stand back from them, not get sucked down by them. I think the second part is really key, and it's about compassion. And by compassion, I mean being able to meet difficulty with kindness and patience. So in the example of the young mother I was describing, to see that wrecking ball with some degree of kindness for herself, mm-hmm. some compassion for herself. And I think that compassion is a key part of the journey out of depression. But to come to answer your question, I think there is also something about cultivating and growing the positive system. Mm-hmm. So over time, actually being able to really take the Teflon off the joyous, the pleasant experiences, and really savor those in life. So in a way, that kind of aspect of the mind is also being cultivated. So I think those are kind of the three parts in my mind, and these are kind of questions, I guess, that the research needs to address. We know that depression is characterized by negative thinking, negative behavioral patterns. We also know that compassion is a key part of the recovery process. And I think the next 10 years we'll see some really interesting research about whether the cultivation of that positive system, mm-hmm. for joy, for example, is part of the long-term recovery from depression.
And what is the... is there a natural progression between compassion of self and compassion for others? Does one lead to the other?
It's a great, great question. It's a great question. And there's different views about this. There are different views about this. My view is, and as a scientist, when I say view, I always try to turn view into a research program that can then be tested. But my view of compassion is that in its bare elements, compassion is compassion is compassion, whether it's for self or for others. And in partly, the self-other is broken down a little bit. Mm-hmm. Let me say what I mean by that, is that we recognize suffering, we have some resonance with that suffering, so that these are the kind of phases I see in compassion. So we recognize suffering, we have some resonance with that suffering, and then we have some impulse. Mm. Sometimes turn into behavior, but not always, some impulse to reduce that suffering. Now for me, that process makes no difference whether it's me mm-hmm. with my own suffering or it's suffering I see in you or anyone else. Mm-hmm. It's still that recognition. Ooh, I can feel some resonance with that, mm-hmm. and I want to reach out and do something with this. The reason I think folks with depression particularly struggle with that difference between self and other compassion is very many people with depression have a real, a real blockage with being able to turn compassion towards themselves. Mm-hmm. My colleague and friend, Krista Neff, describes this, together with her colleague, Christopher Germer, as backdraft. Mm-hmm. So if you open the door with somebody with a long history of adversity and abuse and depression and ask them to put compassion in there, what can happen is actually you get a backdraft of self-criticism and self-loathing and self-destruction. And what she and Christopher Germer have done is very skillfully think about what conditions you need to put in place to support somebody with an abuse history or a really strong inner critic to bring compassion towards themselves. Because those folks can actually quite easily bring compassion towards others, but really struggle to bring it towards themselves. So it's very skillful work, and done well can be incredibly healing, but done badly can actually create a backdraft.
And what is the current situation with mental health in the UK and depression? You know, how prevalent is it and how big of an issue is it?
Well, within the UK, people talk about one in five people at some point in their lifetime will suffer from depression or a common mental health problem. If you take that globally, and you think about at any one time, you can think about it as a 1 billion person problem. If you just stop and think about that, 1 billion people at any one time in the world will have some form of mental health problem that potentially could be helped by some of the approaches, the mental health approaches that we have.
So what's the difference between me splitting up with a girlfriend and going through, you know, weeks of really, you know, real sadness and versus what you call those one in five people having depression? Is that similar? Would that count as that one, you know, at one point in my life?
It's a great question, and I think there's, you know, we could have an hour long conversation about just that. I think it's really unhelpful to pathologize or to make abnormal the normal. Mm-hmm. You know, grief following a loss, sadness when something happens to us, anger, these are the range of normal emotions. And I think part of what mindfulness is about is allowing, is enabling people to recognize and allow and be with the range of normal emotions, both positive and negative. So it's not about not being sad, not being angry, not feeling feelings of disappointment or shame. I think they, in a nutshell, become mental health problems when the second arrow, to use that language of the mind, gets overly involved. Mm-hmm. And suddenly, you know, we split up with our girlfriend, and instead of just a sense of sad, and that, it's like layers of thinking and belief and view
creating more black squares.
Can create more black squares. Yeah, so with depression, the kind of narratives I would hear in depression would be along the lines of, I'm a worthless human being. I don't deserve to be in a relationship. If people discover the real me, they'll reject me. Now, people all have negative thoughts, but when those negative thoughts really get ingrained, that can become depression or anxiety, and that person then becomes withdrawn or puts on a facade with it in the world, which is not their real facade. So I think it's really important to make that distinction between the kind of range of normal experience and then the way that can actually, with the second arrow, if you like, of the mind creating suffering or you know, really exacerbating and worsening suffering, with to use that language, in the second arrows of suffering. Yeah.
Is this coming to a point where mindfulness can be a core element in the curriculum, in the education system?
Yeah, well, I come back to my earlier point. That kind of depends on what the science says. If what we find is that this is a great way for kids to learn these skills and it does change the trajectory of their lives, that's a very compelling case for it to be part of the curriculum.
Yeah.
But if it doesn't, then there'll be some learning in that too. And I think that's the key. That's the key point.
And but
I
asking the right questions and testing for the right things.
It's the right question, and then using robust methods to answer those questions. Yeah. So we don't yet know. There's lots of promising evidence.
Yeah. You said about the enthusiasm running ahead of the evidence.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah.
And I think Claire Kelly, when we spoke to her, was quite cautious.
Yeah.
In what making claims that are sort of not sort of backed up.
By the sciences. But what I would say about these developments is the ones that are really showing traction are where people have taken a huge amount of care in developing the curricula. So the mindfulness curriculum that we're using is the Mindfulness in Schools.B curriculum. And it took the guys who developed that, Chris Cullen, Richard Burnett, and Chris O'Neill, I think about 5 or 6 years of standing in front of classes of 30 kids trying things out.
And the kids tweaking it all along
tweaking
the way.
And kids are an honest, you know, you talk about a focus group or some kind of feedback, you know, right?
Because They'll give it to you real. Yeah.
They'll give it to you real. So that curriculum is a curriculum that most teachers can teach and most kids find acceptable. Now, whether it actually has other effects other than being enjoyable and acceptable, that's still an outstanding question. But what is to the enormous credit of those people is that they have really, really developed something that, that teachers can teach. And that's no small feat because it's taught by mainstream teachers, not by experts who are coming from elsewhere. So it's taught by mainstream teachers. And it's taught in a way that makes things really acceptable. And I'll give you just two examples. One example is what they call the Fofbok practice. You know, Fofbok, it's kind of, people hear the word Fofbok. I never heard that word before. That's kind of interesting. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. Well, it means feet on floor, bottoms on chair. Mm-hmm. Kids get that. 11, 12, 13, 14-year-old kids go, I'm Fofbok, that makes sense. Let's start the lesson with a Fofbok. Mm-hmm. That's kind of clever to come up with that. Another one they came up with, which a lot of kids like, is the thought buses idea. We have thoughts. We've talked about this already, right? We're standing at a bus stop, and a bit like all the buses, when you're heading home from school at the end of the day, you don't have to get on every single bus. Mm-hmm. You can actually choose which bus you're going to get on. So if the bus comes along that says, I haven't done enough revision for all my GCSEs, I'm going to really flunk my GCSEs, maybe I shouldn't turn up, or maybe I should get a whatever, that's a thought bus. Now, it may or may not be true, right? But it's a thought bus. And whether the kid chooses to get on that thought bus. So what they've done is they've really developed a whole range of practices, video clips, resources, materials that kids can relate to. And I think that's incredibly smart and incredibly clever. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Good, good.
So just one final question.
Yeah.
It's a question that we ask on the Action for Happiness course in the first week, which kind of tees us up for the rest of the 8 weeks. But what really matters in life for you?
For me personally?
Yeah.
Great question. I think what really matters for me more and more with time is actually making a positive difference for other people. Whether that's students that I work with, or patients that I work with, or colleagues that I work with in my immediate circle, or in terms of my science, doing science that will actually have an impact and make a difference. Mm-hmm. So I'm very proud of a body of work that suggests that mindfulness-based cognitive therapy might provide an alternative for the literally millions of people who are on antidepressants. So to provide that choice, that option for people, feels like a piece of work that is of value and of benefit to other people. And the same thing, you know, when I see my children or my colleagues thriving, and I think, have I played some small part in enabling that to happen? That gives me great joy.
Wonderful. If they want to find out more about your work and get in touch, how can they do that?
The Oxford Mindfulness Centre. So we have a website, and that describes all of the work that we do.
Okay. All right, well, thank you very much for doing this. We're truly honoured.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. Really great to connect with you and to do this interview.
Thank you.